I've been working on a variety of topics, focusing mainly on data from experimental games in developing countries, and studying, for example, how individual behavior affects welfare, or also understanding social preferences such as inequality, aversion, envy, and allocative efficiency. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. The paper I would present today is co-authored with Marcel Fauchon, who is based at the Stanford University. And what I would try to do is, in a sense, one of the innovative part of the paper, at least we believe, is the sort of the experimental design. We have introduced a novel experimental design, which in a sense tries to create an integrative kind of design to ask both questions of efficiency as well as equity. So most of, by the way, how many of you are familiar with experimental games? So if I say, let's say, the dictator game, trust game, ultimatum game, does everybody know what they are?
You might want to explain that.
Explain, okay. All right, okay. Okay. So so in a sense, one of the sort of contribution of this paper is the fact that there are many experimental games which look at, let's say, equity questions, efficiency questions. And in this paper, we try to create one sort of experimental game which incorporates very different aspects of questions of equity as well as efficiency, but in an integrative manner. So because of this, I think the sort of one of the important contribution is in terms of design. So just be patient if I devote most of my time in presenting the paper on design issues, because I think that's one of the important contributions. Okay? Now, usually it's better to start instead of making it like a fictional story where you create suspense about what the final result is going to be. I think it's always advisable to start with the main results first. So if some of you are bored with my presentation and go, at least you'll have my main results, the main results from the paper. So as I have said, the sort of one of the main contributions we believe is that this is a novel experiment which looks at pairs, couples, so individuals, an individual pair with another pair, with another person, and they are making separable allocative and equity decisions. So when we say efficiency, essentially using the resources you have in the best way in order to get the maximum level of output is an equity of efficiency. But an equity question is, after you have produced your output, how do you divide it? So are you dividing it equitably, or is someone with a power, or is someone with certain characteristics is taking the higher share of the income of the output that is produced? And in order to do that, what we did was we created, as I said, an integrative framework which incorporates basically the dictator, the ultimate and trust games. And these are the sort of the workhorse of experimental economics. Now, to give you an idea of what type of games these are, now the dictator game is a game with, all of these games are very, very simple games. And usually the idea of experimental economics, experimental games, is to simplify the decision scenario so that when people make those simple decisions to elicit as much of the preferences of those individuals as possible. So in the dictator game, and usually this game is used in order to measure altruism, what is done is you call, let's say, two individuals who don't know each other to your laboratory. So because these individuals are anonymous, because they don't know each other, they have no history behind them. Yeah? If you call, let's say, two friends, and basically they are friends, then their friendship would drive their decision in the laboratory. Yeah? So in that case, what you observe may be reciprocity, not altruism, because one of the friends was helping the other friend last week is basically reciprocating. But in dictator games, in typical dictator games, what we do is we bring two individuals who don't know each other, yeah? So they have no social link with each other, and when they make decisions, they don't also see each other, they don't have any communication between each other. And you give one of the person, who is called the dictator, a certain amount of money. So let's say 10 euros. And you ask that person who got that 10 euros to give any amount of money to the other person. You can give all the 10 euros, you can give nothing, you can give 1 euro, whatever amount. So the idea is, always when you design a certain game, there will be some problems. But the idea is, now this must measure altruism. Now if this person gives, now if you take, for example, standard economic analysis, standard economic analysis would predict you would not give anything because there is no consequence on you. You have no relationship with that individual. It's completely an unknown person. Yeah? You will not have any interaction with that person because you don't know with whom you are interacting. So essentially, if you take the sort of the basic assumption of economics, which says individuals are selfish, then the prediction is you would give nothing. That person would give nothing. So if you take all the 10 euros, the other person would give nothing. But in most games, these games have been used again and again in rural societies, urban societies, in laboratories, in the field, everywhere. And they have been extensively used in experimental research. And what you find is, in fact, the sort of the median kind of contribution is around 40%, or donation is around 40%, 50%. So even when there is no link with the other person, when there is no consequence about your relationship with the other people, people are willing to give some part of it. So this is used as a measure of that. Now, in the ultimate end game, you have also two players. Yeah? And like the dictator game, one would be given a certain amount of money. Now, that person also transfers whatever amount of money he wants to the other person. So just like the dictator game. But the difference in the ultimate end game is, if the second person, the recipient, says, this is an unfair amount of money, and they refuse to offer that offer, then both the players would not get anything. Both would go from the laboratory without getting any money. Okay? Now, this type of game usually is used in order to measure sense of fairness. Now, mind you, from standard economic analysis, the prediction is even that person gives the other person 5 cents, he should accept. Because taking 5 cents is better than going home without. Yeah? So any positive amount should be accepted. That is a prediction of standard economic analysis, which assumes selfish interests, selfish preferences. But in many ultimate end games, even offers as much as 30% are rejected. Yeah? Even when the person transfers, let's say, something like 3 euros from his money, the other person could go home with 3 euros, but they reject, and both of them would go home with that. Now, this ultimate game is well established as a sort of a measure of fairness. How much does the recipient consider, how much money is fair? Right? So this is what's called the ultimate game. The ultimate game has also been used extensively. Now, the third game is what's called the trust game. In the trust scheme, what is done is, just like that, two individuals, you give the money to one person. Now the other person transfers any amount of money to the second person. Now any amount of money that is transferred to the second person would be multiplied by the experimenter. So let's say by 3. So let's say the first person transfers 5 euro, retained the 5 euro for himself, he transfers 5 euro. As an experimenter, I would increase that 5 euro to 15 euros. So I would give 15 euros to the recipient. Now the decision of the recipient is how much to give back to the initial. He can give back, let's say, 5 euro, the first transfer. He may not transfer anything, he may not give back anything, or he may give back even more than €5. So essentially, this is used to measure trust. The amount of money the first person sent to the second person is a measure of trust. Because if you trust the other person completely, the best decision is to transfer all the €10. Because the €10 multiplied by 10 would be £30. And if they equally divide, both of them would get £15, I mean €15, and both of them would get a lot of money. But if you don't trust the other person, because after transferring all your €10, if he takes all the €30 and goes home, doesn't send you back anything, then basically you are going to lose. So how much you trust the other person, in a sense, especially when you play anonymously, how much you basically trust a random individual in society, this could be a good measure of trust. Okay, the more the money that is sent by the first individual, the more the trust of that individual, because he's expecting a return back from the recipient. Okay? So these are very, very standard, repeatedly used games in order to measure altruism, sense of fairness and trust in societies. Yeah? So, but usually these games are played separately as individual games. I'll come back to negotiation. Negotiation is something we introduce in our design. Okay? So these are not new, these are, as I said, very, very widely used external campaigns. Okay? Now, one of the things the results we found from our experimental design is, in fact, subjects attain a very high level of efficiency. Yeah? So as we'll see, it will become clear right away when we say there is a sort of a maximal, unique level of output they can produce from the resources we give them in the experiment. And a lot of people approach that output. So there is a surprisingly high level of efficiency. But surprisingly, when there is negotiation between the two couples, usually efficiency is lower. Still a relatively high level of efficiency, but compared to the other treatments, I'll come back to the treatments, the efficiency falls down when there is negotiation. And we have some idea why it falls down. Now, the other important result we get is, in order to attain the maximum level of output from the resources you have, you have to use your resources in the best way possible. Now, the best way possible could be taking some money which belongs to her and using it, let's say, on an activity I'm involved in. If I'm, let's say, I'm capable of using her money better than she does, it pays for both of us to maximize the total output. It's better if she gives me that money, I produce the total output, we divide it up. We'll have a larger share to divide up. Now, what we call here an endowment effect is the initial amount of money she has would have an effect on efficiency. Now, if it was a perfectly efficient allocation, this should not have, because she should transfer the money to someone who uses his best, so they maximize the total output, then they divide it up in a certain way. So the maximum the two have would be maximized if you ignore what amount of endowment each one of them have at the initial. But as we see, endowment effects are very, very, very strong. And they are one of the reasons why the highest level of efficiency is not obtained. Now, in many cases, when individuals are given, so as we'll see in the game, we will give some endowments to the two players who are coupled with each other. They produce something, yeah, and they divide up that production. Now, in some of the treatments, an individual will have more power to take most of the surplus from that production. And what we observe is when individuals have that power, they usually use it. They take a lot of it. individuals are not highly equipped. Yeah? If they have the power, they usually use that power in order to maximize, to extract most of the surplus. So this is what is we observe. So when they have, they would appropriate most of the surplus. Now another very interesting finding is, in one of the treatments, we asked individuals either to make the decision themselves, yeah, or delegate the decision to the other person, or negotiate between themselves. So in a sense, so this in a sense measures the demand for negotiation, yeah? You want, some people want to arrive at a negotiated settlement. Some people want to solve the solution by themselves, yeah? So they want to make the decision, they want to take the power. But some people may be happy to delegate power to others. Let the others decide, why should I worry about it? So in one of the treatments, we made these choices available to the subjects. Now in most of the economic literature, then you would not expect people to delegate power to others, because essentially power is one of the crucial things that determines your welfare. The more power you have, you don't delegate it. Huh? So the more power you have, the better your welfare outcome. But surprise, surprise, what you find is, in fact, a significant proportion of the subjects are willing to forego, are willing to delegate their power to others. So instead of making a decision, they delegate the power to the other individual. Now, in a lot of the experimental results in the literature, we find very strong gender effects. Like, let's say, for example, in most cases, let's say, for example, women are less competitive. Women are more cooperative, and so on. But in most of our results, we don't get strong gender effect. So women and men are basically behaving in a very similar fashion, but when men are coupled with women, when women are coupled with men, what we find is, in fact, they become more cooperative. More than when men are matched with men or women are matched with men. So mixed gender seems to increase efficiency. Okay, so these are the main results. Now, I'm sure most of the things I'm saying would be clarified when we go to the details of the design. Okay, now let me go back now. What was the reason that motivated us to look at these issues? Now, both of us are very much interested. We had a lot of research done on basically intra-household allocation. And if you look at most of the dominant intra-household models in economics, most of these intra-household models in economics assume household efficiency. That means if, let's say, husbands and wife have a certain amount of resource, they would negotiate, they would exchange those resources among themselves in order to maximize the output for them from those resources. So this is the underlying assumption of most intra-household models. Now, particularly, arguably, the sort of the dominant model now in intra-household allocations is what's called the collective model. And the collective model is basically based on that assumption, and it derives the allocative implications of efficiency within the household. Yeah? So because we are interested in intra-household allocations, and because efficiency is a crucial assumption, one of the motivations for doing this research is this fact. But in addition to this, while the dominant model in intra-household allocations is based on efficiency, on allocative efficiency in households, a very, very influential paper written by Chris Udrich came in 1996. And that paper looked at essentially farm efficiency in Burkina Faso. And what Chris Udry and his colleagues did was they collected very detailed data about resource allocation in among Burkina Faso farmers. And one of the sort of characteristic feature of many West African agricultural, West African rural areas is the fact that there are clearly separated plots that are managed, owned by the wife and by the husband. So essentially what Chris and his colleagues did was they looked at how, or specifically how, fertilizer is allocated on plots that are controlled, managed by the wife, and plots that are controlled by the husband. And what they found was most of the fertilizer is controlled by the husband. Now, if households are efficient, then that fertilizer, even though it's controlled by the husband, should be effectively utilized both on the husband's as well as the wife's plots. Because remember, if you use too much fertilizer on the husband's land, that would in fact decrease productivity. So if you, let's say, take 1 kilogram of fertilizer from the husband's plot, and you, if you invest it on the wife's plot, and if total output increases more, you reduce the output from the husband's plot, but you increase the output on the wife's plot by a larger amount, then that sort of reallocation must happen. So that's the implication of efficiency. But what Chris Woodry found was, in fact, those kind of allocations are not happening. Most of the fertilizer is invested on the husband's land, while more fertilizer is required on the wife's land. And he argued that a lot of the household models that are based on efficiency are misleading, because we observe a lot of inefficiency among households, because households do not allocate their resources in such a manner to maximize output. So another motivation for us was this idea, and as we'll see, the game is framed as an allocation of fertilizer between two plots of land. So the motivation behind the game's design is also obviously. Now, in addition to this, another motivation is, now we are looking at allocative efficiency, but with distribution at the same time, and particularly we look at, so both equity and efficiency questions are integrated, so that's also another motivation for this design. And still another one is, you know, if you look at most of the intra-household models, those intra-household models do not incorporate insights from behavioral economics. Now, one of the most important insights from behavioral economics is what's called social preferences. So in standard economic analysis, we have selfish preferences. Economic agents are interested only on their welfare. But with behavioral economics, we know that economic agents are interested about the welfare of others. They have altruism, they have reciprocal relationships, and so on. They have rival relationships, and so on. So the other motivation is to integrate those insights from behavioral economics into intra-household analysis. Okay? And finally, we want also to look at sort of different power structures. So ultimately, what we want to do is to understand how married couples essentially use the resources they have. But because it's very difficult to find married couples in Norwich who would come to our laboratory, because most of the students are not married, so selecting, you'd have only a very small number of. So we can't do it with actually married couples. So what we did was, we basically now are randomly matching male to male, female to male, female to female, in order to understand what would happen with randomly selected different genders. What do we observe? So mind you, husbands, actual husbands and wives are not random males. Yeah, they know each other, they love each other at least, even if it's arranged marriage, there is some information between them. So what our expectation is, what we capture here is a sort of a floor. Yeah? If we find these results for randomly matched people, so the sort of the efficiency level, the cooperation most likely would be higher than that with married couples. Okay? Okay, let me...
How many minutes do I have?
20.
Oh, okay. Okay, let me now go back up. I'm sort of rewinding from starting from the from the last and coming back. So let me give you an idea of the experimental design. And I think a lot of, when I say allocative efficiency, when I say equity, exactly what we mean in this experimental design would become clearer when I explain the designs and the procedure. Okay, so these games are played by University of East Anglia students. The University of East Anglia has got its own lab, so the games are played at the University of East Anglia, but the funding came from Stanford. Okay. And in each session, we have identical number of males and females. So in each session, exactly 8 male students and 8 female students are recruited. No? So in each session, we have 16 people.
Can you say a little bit how they're selected, the students?
Because this is a proper laboratory, you know, when you have a proper laboratory, you could have a roster of registered users. So basically, these are all students, but as many students that are interested to play games are in a very long list. Now, essentially, what they do is when a game is organized, they would exactly know, let's say, which students have played for the last game, the game before that, which type of game they have played. Yeah? So they randomly select from those, let's say, who haven't played a similar game very recently. Yeah? So if you want also a specific type of students, you can use that kind of stratification.
But the roster is all students in university?
Not all, because some students are not interested too. So these are registered students. Who are interested because
so
you know,
so they
yeah, you know, in experimental games, you pay actual money.
Okay.
So this is in fact, for there are some professional students who are, who are always registered, who are always ready to play games. It's is a very good source of income also. You know, to avoid those, you know, sort of professional players, because if they play a similar kind of game last week, they're most likely that would improve their. So what the lab does is it roots out this kind of students and it samples from the rest of the students. So they would be sent emails and they would say, would come at this point. So that's how the recruitment system. So there is, if you have a properly established laboratory, you'd have also a properly established protocol for recruitment. Yeah? So it relies on that. Okay?
What makes them identical? What do you mean by that?
Well, the same number.
All
sessions are 16. Mm-hmm. Same number. And in all of them, we have 8 females and 8 males. So the same.
What about the what do you call it, the what do you call it, players? What about the characteristics of the players? You don't account for that.
No, the only gender.
Okay.
So when we register, let's say for the session at this hour, we invite, we also have some reserves. Yeah, so let's say we would call something like 20 students, because if some don't turn up, we would use the reserves. But in one session when we play experimental games, there are exactly 8 female and 8 male students. Because essentially we want, you know, we are trying to mimic, because at least heterosexual marriages are between two sexes. So what we are trying to see is how the matching between males and females affects their decision. So the idea is we always control for the gender combination, for the sex combination. Yeah?
Sorry, one more question. I'm still wondering about what you said before about this being a floor for marriage. Because I see how you're going to get gender differences, but marriage comes with a whole bunch of issues. I mean, you could have an increase of altruism, say, that presumably would drive down efficiency, so this could not only be a bottom line thing, right? Or you could have issues of assertive mating, which will also change efficiency
Yeah, that's exactly
either way, right?
Yeah.
So how, can you explain it, or why do you think this is going to give any information about the matrix itself, about the interval?
You know, the sort of the allocative efficiency and equity we observe among randomly matched people, as we do, most likely is a sort of the bottom line. Because in marriage, you don't have random allocation.
Yeah, exactly.
So
why would the efficiency go up? Why would you expect to blow up in a marriage situation?
Because if you are altruistic, reallocation of resource becomes easier, yeah? Division.
More efficient.
No, one of the reasons for allocation efficiency is moving resource, let's say, the resource you own, moving it to your husband's. And we generally expect if altruism is higher, moving resources between people would be higher also. It would be easier, I mean. Yeah? They care about each other for equity, we would expect. So essentially, what I wouldn't expect any, unless it is a very sort of a very really bad marriage, then you'd expect, yeah. On the average, I think that matching would be better than random matching. People, you know, spouses would understand each other, would love each other, would support each other, and so on, more than completely unknown, anonymously met, randomly matched individuals. Because in our game, these are randomly matched. So that's why, in a sense, we think that this is a, what we capture is a sort of the bottom line. And real marriage most likely would have more efficiency, more equity than what we are.
But then this can also work for power structure, not for the marriage, but for example in team at work where you have a mixed composition. So, for example, in firms, you know what I mean? The composition, the gender composition among the managers, firms, entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And the power structure within these things might be in this sense.
But mainly our structure focuses on two individuals matching with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why
it is very large, like with more kind of players.
No, that would be a different one.
Okay. Even if it's always like
it would complicate, you know, you have a different conceptual problem when you have more than.
Okay.
Here you have specifically two mites, and essentially we are trying to mimic sort of heterosexual kind
no
of
production thing. Also.
Huh?
No production, we don't have production.
No, we have production, but I will explain how, what kind of production it means. So not actual real effort, but there is production. Okay, so we have exactly 8 females and 8 males. And because of this, we have 8 ways of pairing males to females. If you are a male, there are 8 females, you can be paired with 8 of them. But if you are male, you can be paired only with the remaining 7. So essentially, each individual can have pairs 15, with 7 of the same sex and 8 of the other sex. Yeah? So in addition to this, we had also a treatment where individuals play alone without being matched. And each one of them are played 3 rounds. So because of this, each individual would be engaged in 18 different rounds. Okay? So each treatment done 3 times, 3 rounds, yeah.
So logistically, you're talking about working on 8 computers or 16?
No, 8.
8.
No, 16 computers, I mean.
16?
Yeah, each individual would be sitting.
So it's individually sitting in front of one computer,
yeah.
Even when they're paired?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they don't know.
So they don't know what the...
The only thing they know is the gender of the other person.
Okay.
Yeah. You are matched with a male, you are matched with a female. But each one of them, they are sitting in a cubicle, they can't see each other.
Okay.
Yeah. So all the communications are terminal. So there is a software also, which is called a Vedetree, which is almost used in every part of the world. So that software basically coordinates. The decision of one will be taken to the other person who is matched with that individual person. Okay? So, in fact, matching this, having an exhaustive matching pairing by itself was a very, very difficult task. Okay? So there is one treatment for one place. And we have six treatments. One is where each individual plays alone, then we have what we call the dictator, ultimatum, trust, negotiation, and the final one, decide, delegate, or negotiate. Okay? Now, the experiment is framed as an allocative efficiency of an allocation of a fixed amount of fertilizer, basically influenced by the idea from Woodruff's paper. So, essentially, both couples have a total amount of 100 units, or 1 unit of fertilizer, yeah? And they are allocating this fertilizer on 2 plots of land. Now, the initial endowment of fertilizer is not always equitable. In some cases, 50 is first allocated to one, 50 is allocated to the other, but there are cases where all the 100 is allocated to the other, and I receive 0, the 80 is allocated to the other, I receive 20, and so all these 5 different endowment allocations. So there are the extreme case where all the 100 fertilizer is controlled by one player, and there are cases equal and unequal, determined by this person. Now, the production function on these 2 plots is different. So in most cases, the marginal productivity on the 2 fertilizers differ. In most of the production functions, we used a second-order polynomial production function, a quadratic function. And because of this, we have diminishing marginal returns to fertilizer. And because we have diminishing marginal returns, and we fixed the parameters so that in most cases you need reallocation of fertilizer from one plot to the other. But we have also some linear production functions. So if you have linear production function, marginal productivities would be constant on the two. So it would be always higher on one plot, so all the fertilizer must be allocated on that one plot. So in that case, you have a corner solution, because all the resource must be devoted. So we have a combination of these production functions. So efficiency requires allocating fertilizer and the plot with the highest marginal productivity. So even if I have all the fertilizer, if the marginal productivity is good on the others, then I have to give all the fertilizer to the other. Allocative efficiency requirement. Because the total product we get from out of it will be the maximum. Okay? So the total surplus output produced depends on the chosen allocation of fertilizer on the 2 plots. Then this is shared between the 2 couples. Now, how is it shared? Then depending on the variation of our allocation, distribution decisions are made. Then we have these different 6 treatments. Now, the first treatment is where players play alone. So basically, they decide how much fertilizer to allocate on the 2 plots, and every output they were to consume it. So they are not much of this anymore. Now this treatment is used as a baseline, and it is also a sort of practice that all the sessions start with this. So the students would be, the players would be familiar, yeah? You know, it may not be intuitively understandable, yeah, how the reallocation increases your output. So they would practice.
So it's a sort of practice, right?
Now the second treatment is what we call the dictator treatment. Now each match subject, so all the other treatments, they are matched with another player. So each match subject makes a decision about the allocation, how much fertilizer to allocate between the 2 plots, and the division of the output also. I will take this amount, the other person will take this amount. But both of them make this decision simultaneously, separately. And we choose randomly one of the decisions, and that is implemented. So because both the allocation of fertilizer and the division of output is decided by one individual, that's why we call it a dictator. So the player is dictating both the allocation and the division of output. The third treatment is the ultimatum. Here, one of the randomly selected subjects will make the fertilizer allocation, as well as the division of output. So just like the dictator, they would make also the division of output. Now that division of output would be taken to the second couple, yeah, to the second person. If the other person accepts, then that the decision would be implemented. If the person rejects it, then both of them will get zero. So they would lose a total out. That's why it's called an ultimatum. Just like as I explained in the ultimatum, the amount that is transferred from the first person to the other, if it's not accepted by the second, it would be again.
That's why it was an ultimatum. Now the fourth treatment is a trust game. So one randomly selected subject will make the fertilizer allocation, and the other decides on the distribution.
So the amount of output will be decided by me, but I would not decide the division. So essentially, I must have a certain level of trust in order to be worried about maximizing output. I must have a certain level of trust that he would return back a significant proportion of output.
Now, the fourth one is what we call the negotiation. So one randomly selected subject will make the fertilizer allocation and output distribution, and send this proposal with a short message to the other.
So he would say, he would produce the output, yeah, on the two plots, and he would say, let's divide it this way.
I am dividing this way because of this. I'm a very fair person, I'm a very nice person, or something like that. He would send a message. So the other person looks at that division. Yeah.
If he rejects, then he would propose another fertilizer allocation and a division of the output, and sends back the message. Now, if the other one accepts, that would be implemented. If not, then he would make a second offer. So this continues until both of them make three offers. If after these three offers, after the sixth exchange, they don't agree, they would go back to the initial endowment, and the division would also be allocated.
Now the last one is where the players choose. Now each player chooses one of the games from the following. One, to play the treatment five, that's the negotiation, to negotiate, the one I just explained, or pay a 50 P for a show-up fee, from his or her show-up fee, to play the dictator game.
That means they pay in order to become the decider of both the allocation as well as the division of output, or they are willing to receive 50p, yeah, in order to delegate the decision to the other person.
So the idea here is sort of this measures a sort of demand for power. This measures the demand sort of
for delegation, the preference for delegation,
and this basically captures the sort of the preference for a negotiator settlement. Okay?
Did you experiment with the amount of payment, show up fee and delegation?
Yeah, that was an idea we entertained, but you know, we would proliferate the number of treatments, so we just kept this amount. But you know, if you are particularly interested about sort of elasticity of how, you know, the payments to become a dictator or delegate affects decision, that's what we have to do. But we didn't, because of we had also a very small budget, we can't increase the number of okay. So the experiment uses carefully designed main screen.
Now these decisions, these are a sort of a bit, it's alien, so for when students look at it, they may be confused. So we took a lot of effort to simplify this decision process.
And what we did is we created this kind of a screen. So essentially what you see at the bottom is the initial endowment. So let's say initial fertilizer, let's say to me, the initial fertilizer to the other person. Then you have a slider here. When you grab this slider and move it to the left and the right, the amount of fertilizer that's allocated on plot one and plot B, plot A and plot B would change. Depending on the underlying production function, yeah, if you are moving, let's say, fertilizer from the less fertile to the more fertile plot, total output would increase. And people can observe that here. So when they grab this and pull it here and here, this would change. So they would observe. So if you pull it here, it would become 160, 70 or something, then it would start to decrease. So they can
automatically identify what is the highest level of output they can, which is a couple of experiments.
Yeah. And this shows you the amount of output that is coming from each plot. Yeah.
And we don't, because we are also interested in the endowment effect, if we say plot A is yours, would that affect their decision? You know, if they are completely irrational, they should not worry about this output. They should worry only about this output. A proper rational person who is focusing on allocative efficiency or maximizing total output should focus on this output. Whether it comes from my plot or the other plot, they should be different to that. You worry about a larger amount, how would it be divided? That's a separable decision. But if you are concerned about allocative efficiency, this is the amount you try to maximize.
Now, after that, in this, like this one, there is a slider. Yeah? So when they make distribution decisions, they also move that. So if you move it here, mine is, let's say, 80% of the total output, the other is 20%, and so on. So the decision in allocating the output is also very much simplified. Yeah? Well, you see, this is a very simple graph. But in order to design this in Z3, we were almost going to give up.
How much time did you give them?
If I remember correctly, for all, I think the average time was 1 hour and 15 minutes to make all those decisions. So remember, so they make, they play the six treatments, three each time. So they have 18 decisions to make. So it's a relatively very, very fast. In fact, in addition to this, you had also a very long question about the end. But because it's sort of multiple choice questions, they can also complete that very quickly. But this has significantly simplified the decision process. Have I run out of time? No?
Yes, but I don't know whether you want to
maybe instead of simply talking over you for an hour, did you have any question or probably?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Is the negotiation game simultaneous or sequential?
No, it must be sequential.
Okay.
Because, you know, so there are two people that are matched with each other. Yeah. So we randomly select one. Then that person would make the fertilizer allocation decision. Then would make also the division of the total output. Yeah, and that decision would be sent to the second person. And if that person wants to send some message, because usually almost every time people would send some message, because it's a way of convincing the other person the logic behind their decision. So they would send a short message. So that message is taken to the second person. Now the second person looks at the decision of the first person. Yeah? So it must be, by definition, sequential, because they have to look at the decision of the first person. Then if they agree, that's the end of the game. But they see, and if they don't agree, then they make another allocation decision of fertilizer, and they divide up also the total output, and send also a message to the first.
But if that's the case,
yeah.
The first mover will always win, right? He can say minimum endowment, and he can always reject, and by backward induction, he knows that if I give the minimum amount,
yeah.
And even if I reject till the last point when the second mover says something, I'm anyway going to give this endowment.
But, you know, if they don't agree after three exchanges, you know, we cannot make it completely open. Because some people are very strong in negotiations, so they would continue for 6-7. So what we need was, they have only an option to go up to the third round. If they don't agree after that means 6 exchanges from each one of them, then it would be, they would go to the default. So they would divide up. The output would be decided by the initial endowment. Yeah. So there is no allocation. And in most cases, that would not give you the maximum level of output. And the division of the surplus, the division of the output would also be dependent on the initial endowment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So it would not depend if there is no agreement, if the negotiation ends with disagreement, the fallback position is the initial endowment allocation. So the person cannot strategize like that. Because it could always be rejected by the other,
mm-hmm.
because the other knows the most likely the initial endowment allocation would be much better than the very bad offer from the other. So that's why it would not give strong power to one individual.
I was wondering about the ordering of the decisions. So first do the players know that they'll make first the one decision and then they will make the other decision?
Oh, you mean between the fixed treatments?
Yeah, but they know that they'll first decide on the allocation for the fertilizer and then on the
Oh yeah.
They'll make both decisions.
Yeah, each, you know, they have an instruction for all the fixed. Yeah. In fact, the first before they start playing the game, they would read the whole instruction for all the six games. But in terms of, I thought you were asking about order effects.
I was also wondering, what if you switch it? What if they decide on the distribution of the generated income first, and then they look at the allocation of the fertilizer?
From here does the income come?
No, but
you know, the idea is to mimic, yeah? You know, the idea is to mimic what basically happens in agricultural households, yeah? So you produce your output, then you fight over the division of that output.
But you could say, well, we split everything equally, and then you make decisions from that basis.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of the decisions are equitable.
Yeah.
So that should come from the decision of... Do you get me? If we start from, if we say within the design of the game, that the output will be equitably distributed, then we are not capturing the preference of the... So what we want is to capture the allocative efficiency of the players, as well as their distribution preferences. Yeah? So because of the way they split up the output would basically tell you. So some of the empirical results. But by the way, you can download. I think I put it at the end. You can download the paper from this. This is Marcel's website. So the full paper is available. This is Stanford. So far shows Marcel's website. So you can download. So the idea is because we want to capture the preference of the individuals. Otherwise, it would be the division of the output would be exogenous. We are the one who is dividing it up. But actually, most of the division is very much the sort of the difference between 50% of the actual division is relatively small. So most people are sort of equitable in terms of 50%. But did you get me? It's also a question of external validity. We are trying to mimic its agricultural households. So they produce, their income is coming from that production, then they divide up the income. So first, do they produce efficiently? And do they worry about maximizing output? That's one question. The other is a distribution preference. Yeah.
Well, my question is it's a bit broader. I hope you don't mind if I ask it. So I didn't really get the opportunity to ask somebody who does experimental games in developed countries and developing country contexts. But if you were, I wanted to ask about context sensitivity.
Yeah.
So if you were to take this laboratory and take it to the field, to Burkina Faso or Ethiopia, are you assuming that you would find similar results? And I ask obviously because I do wonder about the macro-contextual sensitivity. Cultural norms, macroeconomic austerity, famine,
yeah,
whether any of those things might change the decisions of the players. So when you take it from a context of the, you know, rarefied atmosphere of a large campus,
yeah, yeah,
and you go to rural Burkina Faso, are you assuming that you would find similar results?
No, you know, from my experience, because if I go with that kind of preconceived idea, I have been always disappointed. So, you know, the results, as you said, you know, the context is very important. Even though, you know, the idea of experimental game is, you know, in the sense you are creating a sort of clinically sanitized environment so that people will not think about their social, you know, when you study individuals in their life, you know, life is very, very dense social network. So as an experimenter, it's very difficult to understand why people behave in that context, because you don't have detailed information about that dense social network. So essentially what we try to do in experimental methods is you bring them into a sort of sanitizing, they are not in any kind of social relationships, you are trying to capture the preference of that individual without being affected with either friendship or other type of social relationship. Now, when you take these games to now even then, when you play these games in even in sanitized, properly organized laboratories, you know, you understand there is obviously there will be some elements. Even though you minimize the impact of context, there would be some, definitely there would be some element of context influence in your experience. Yeah? Now, take this into your lab, yes? Where you don't
take
have
the lab, not take it, I mean, take the whole lab, make it a lab in the field. So it's a
also ideally, if you have this lab.
Yes, you're taking the lab to the field.
Yeah, to the field. Of course, because of the context, we don't expect. That's one thing. The other thing is, you know, from my experience of playing experimental games in developing countries, we don't have this kind of properly laboratory.
Yeah. Yes.
But we try to mimic a sort of laboratory. So what we do is we call the farmers into a school, we use classrooms, and in the classroom they don't communicate with each other, and so on. But even then, one of the most important effect is, let's say, these farmers usually are sampled from the same village. You don't have a cubicle like you have in the world. So they
see each other.
They see each other. So the fact that they are coming from the same village, they see each other, you could be looking at a neighbor who is very nasty, because he may be behaving in a certain way. So we know we cannot control that. Yeah? I'm trying to
it's hard
the issues at different levels. Even in the Western sanitized laboratory, there is some sort of contamination for the context. Now you go to the rural developing countries, definitely you will find people sampling from the same way. So that would be. So when you analyze that, you have to take into account this. So for example, we have played some games. We have played, in Oxford, and we played them in Ethiopia.
Mm.
And when you compare the results, they are significantly different. But part of that difference is because of design. Mm. Yeah? It's mainly because of the individuals who are seeing each other, so social desirability, and so on. So when you interpret your results, you have to take into account this this contextual, this sort of also technological kind of impacts. Yeah.
But the big question then was, do experimental economists who do this type of work, map in the fields, in this, you know, utopia where you don't have those contamination effects, imagine that this doesn't happen, do experimental economists assume that that you would get the same results in Oxford and rural Burkina Faso, assuming that there was a possibility of contamination?
It depends on the type of questions you ask. So for example, if you take dictator games, if you take ultimatum games, they have been played in almost every corner of the world. And surprise, the results are mainly perfect.
Yeah.
So for example, like in almost all cases, in no place was, let's say, the paper game. This is the median or the mean zero. In almost every case, there is a positive amount given. In most cases, people would not accept, let's say, very, very small amounts, so if it's less than 20%. So, you know, some of the games could be capturing very universal kind of human behavior. So that's why, you know, some of the games could be captured. But you should not conclude from that that every game will capture and say that what are observed in Norwich or in Oxford is going to be observed. But, you know, it's an issue of in any discipline, yeah, there are some universal characteristics which make observed behavior, but there are some which are highly context specific.
Yeah.
And because of the results. So exactly the experimental results.
Well, if you get the funding, it would be nice to do the same experiment
in
Ethiopia and see whether that holds true.
Yeah, I'm presenting this in order to directly or indirectly influence funders to give us to do it in Ethiopia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So it's about these gender differences. If you compare outcomes, comparing the same-sex pairs with the so the reason that you provide is that then because these participants they only know what's the gender of the other partner.
Yeah.
So the reason that you provide in this paper is for this negotiation outcomes that you observe in mixed players is that they act like in a real couple or miss this part. So what's the so why
you know
the pair perspective should behave differently or towards a more negotiative and collaborative way if it does not.
You know. Essentially, we don't find the gender effects that are found in many experimental games, like, let's say, like women are contributing more, being more altruistic, giving more to the other person. We don't find women are the same in our sample. The females are the same as the effect you find is in terms of matching.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have mixed sex, female male or male female, if the male is, let's say, if the male is, let's say, deciding in the negotiation, they become more cooperative to a female than a male to a male.
Mm-hmm.
So if the impact is a matching effect rather than a pure sort of gender effect. It's not a question of that women are behaving in a different way than men.
No, but then what then drives this individual? So it's like about kind of social
norms,
making them
say
more
prone
to negotiation
when
they react to a woman or to the same sex.
Yeah, it is difficult because it's happening on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only because of men.
Okay.
But
so
women are also.
So when the first decision is taken by a woman, then it's.
When the decision flows from men to women, or from women to men.
Mm-hmm.
That is significantly different from the case where women to men to men. So it's not, you know, it's not specifically a very specific gender effect. Huh? It's not because, let's say, men when they are with women are different from when women are with men. They are almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that a woman is deciding towards a man, and a man is deciding towards a woman, both have the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's not exactly a gender effect,
mm-hmm.
it is a sort of matching effect.
And it's not too much about the structure of power, because it goes
two ways.
So it's more like worried about the diversity, say, the gender.
Exactly. It is the composition of the match, which is important, rather than the gender of the individual. And I don't think we have any idea why that's
So we know that there is something going on in the interactions between male and female, female and male. That's something that comes out. How do you? Is it possible? Did you feel it was possible to transit from there to say this is a couple? This is something that expresses the behavior or the dynamics of a couple. Because somehow the games do not seem to be the way couples interact. That's kind of like my gut feeling. In some cases you don't, like one partner does not have a choice. So in this case, choice always exists.
Yeah.
In some cases, so it's kind of like, or didn't you even go that far? Then
no, we didn't. So essentially this is a case where couples have choices. Like if one is a prisoner of the other, essentially this kind of work. But also, but I would also say, I think there is also a sort of exaggeration about how, let's say, one spouse controls the other. Because even in societies where there is a very strong patriarchy, for example, if you take Ethiopia, for example, the country I know very much, patriarchy is very strong. But even in that society, the agency of women is very, very strong.
But I was kind of thinking also...
I'm not saying it's like a matriarchy, but that it does not automatically imply that women have no power.
I was also thinking, and one of the questions when I asked whether they're playing alone or they're talking.
Yeah.
That's typically a situation that couples that we would have with couples. Like there wouldn't be a set number of six interactions where you negotiate. That's basically a dialogue.
Yeah.
Could be better, worse, one-sided, or long. So the interaction can be like 25 interactions, could be 100 interactions. Could be I decide it's this, and it's one interaction. So, but would it make sense to simulate with the dialogue? So actually having two people sitting in front of a computer and making the decision together.
You know, the experimental games deliberately simplify those complications. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
There are other methods. For example, I know, what was his name? He's a well-known, he's a well-known psychologist. Who is very famous also on marriage studies. And what they did is they invite husband and wife, put them in a room, and there is a glass. They don't observe the husband and wife, they don't observe the observers, but there are a group of research team with their notes, and they would ask them, remember a sort of a serious fight you had recently, and discuss about that. Now they actually observe how they discuss, how they communicate, and so on. Because you know it's real. They really get angry. So some of them start to shout on each other. They didn't know that. And do you know what they did? They used that observation in order to predict who divorced whom after something like 10 years or 5 years. And that prediction was correct, something like that. 80%. Now that's a different type of view. You observe. You must have a very, very, very well thought out theory of communication. They are observing from the observation of the communication, they are deriving what type of dynamics there is between the spouses. They have a big theory about that. So they are very interested in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So in experimental games, you don't have that kind of theory which can interpret a real type, a real life type of interaction. Yeah? So that's why you depend on very simplified decision scenarios, but which capture some important things that likely would happen also in the area. Only some element of it.
Okay. We need to shut up.